Hey everybody, welcome to a brand new episode of the Retro Raw Rundown here on Inside the Ropes, episode 210, covering the May 19th, 1997 episode.
20 years ago, Kenny, we're back in the DeLorean, remember?
Yeah, Raw's War, DeLorean, back in time, that whole shit. sorry that it's late this week. I can't even remember why it's late. I can't even remember why we didn't get to do it last week, because...
You had a Triple H conference call to do, I think.
Yes, that was it. I found out at the last minute I had that to do, and then I had other stuff to do, and then we had weekends, and then Sondra was going to Backlash, and then we had to do the takeover thing, and there was all the stuff going on. So, yeah, a little bit late, but here we are. We always catch you up in the end. So, we're here to talk about the May 19th episode of Monday Night Raw from 1997. This is way before Kane got very obsessed about a date, for no particular reason.
This is way before Kane.
Well, not that long before Kane.
Well, not that long before. I mean, we know that Paul Bearer has a secret, but is it... Kane has a history with women, right? I know that we're going to get there. But, like, right. There's something about Tori. And yes, I do know about the Katie Vick thing.
I mean, we're years away from Tori, and we're years away from Katie Vick. So you've got a while. But do you know about the May 19th thing? I'm assuming you've heard about it.
I've heard about it because, when was it? Like, I feel like a few years back, they were teasing something with May 19, and then Kane, like, came back with a mask or something.
Basically, in 2006, Kane was, like, really angry about the date May 19th, for, like, no reason.
Is this when there was fake Kane?
Yes.
Was that Luke Gallows?
Yes.
Yes.
All correct information.
See, I have wrestling history knowledge, everyone. I know stuff.
I love that any time we bring up any form of wrestling history, you have this defense mechanism of this minority of people who have clearly, like, been dicks to you about it.
And, like, well, because still... a lot of people have been dicks to me about it. Like,
nobody here in our community.
A couple. But I think they've gotten over it.
Oh, it makes me laugh.
Well, I mean, I think they've gotten over it. I think they've come to accept. I think sometimes when we got a bunch of new listeners that came over, you know, followed you from that other place, I feel like some people didn't quite
say their name, can you? Say their name, Sondra. Be dirty. Say the name.
What culture? That place that you used to work.
Don't be horrible to those people.
No, I like most of those people. Most of them are lovely. I've met a good deal of them. I think they were fine. But
the on-screen personalities are lovely.
Yeah, they were. They were lovely. I mean, I don't know many of them super well, but it's not like they were dicks or anything. They were perfectly fine.
It's what you don't say that matters.
I'm trying to be diplomatic here.
Yeah, I don't give a fuck.
I know. but no, like when we got a bunch of new listeners and there was one point where The Undertaker had shown up again or something, and I said something about not liking The Undertaker, because I figured everyone knew by that point, right, that I didn't like The Undertaker. Everyone talks about, like, what's your most controversial wrestling opinion? Like, I think mine's pretty well known. And I got a bunch of tweets from people saying, oh my gosh, you don't like The Undertaker? What's going on? Why is this? I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, I have to explain this all over again. And that's, I mean, I think that was pretty soon before we started Retro Raw, actually. And that Retro Raw kind of was born out of that in a way, which bothered me because I was like, I don't want to have to go through a bunch of WWE history just to prove my fandom. And I almost felt like Retro Raw itself was, I don't know, proving the point or something. So I was like, this is not why I'm doing this show. But
God, you ask Sondra to do a wee show for people and she's raging about it.
I was in quite a mood that week. You know this. But no, I mean, it's every once in a while I still get people who are like, oh, well, you've never seen this angle from this part of history, so that's why you don't understand what's going on right now. And I'm like, well, A, no, I haven't seen that, but I don't think I need to see that to be a wrestling fan. B, no, it's not going to help to send me a YouTube link to it unless I've specifically asked for it, because there's no way I'm going to watch it, because do you know how much wrestling I watch already on a weekly basis for this show?
I think the thing that's difficult is that to try and piece things over a wee bit, I think the Undertaker is someone who is kind of universally loved by wrestling fans. So I think So I think that the issue is more that if somebody listens to this podcast for the first time, well, not this one because we're explaining it, but like if you listen to one and you're just like tearing strips off of them, it's just a bit jarring to listen to because you're so vitriolic about it sometimes. Like, if it's a certain thing, or if he's fucked over somebody you like, or whatever, that I guess maybe if somebody's not heard the context, they're just like, whoa, what's going on? But, and I assume if you get like five of them at once, it's probably quite annoying. The thing that I can only relate it to is that in current WWE, there's the Jinder Mahal thing. And I've had so many tweets of people like, you know, giving me shit for having an opinion. And I'm like, that's fine. But you can give me
shit. Well, I think what's funny about that is that I've been getting the exact same tweets. Like, not, I've been getting the tweets from people who support you that are just as angry at me as the people who agree with me are angry at you.
Yeah. And
so I've been getting it too. I just don't engage quite as much because I'm bad at social media.
I enjoy the chance to do a good gif. So, like, if I get the chance to do like a sassy black girl sass thing, I'm all for it. If I can find that gif and do it as a response, like, giving me an excuse to do that brightens up my day. So,
I can't even do gifs because I don't know how. And I technically could figure it out, but the amount of time it would take my phone to upload a gif and find a gif and load it, and I mean, it would be like an hour later, and it wouldn't matter.
But there's going to be one day where Patreon is responsible for the entire new technology of Sondra. Where
pretty
she,
much
she'll have laptops that work, she'll have phones that are in the 21st century.
Because I have a laptop that just took literally an hour and a half to update itself. Kenny and I were supposed to start recording this an hour and a half ago, but Windows decided I'm going to update myself and restart, and it took an hour and a half. I assume it had to rebuild the entire innards of the computer. I also have a Samsung Galaxy S3, which is why my phone is very slow and doesn't run modern applications very well.
So,
this is my life.
Time to talk about Retro Raw. This is the May 19th episode of Raw. We've had Cold Day in Hell. We're now kind of on the road to King of the Ring. Last week we got Ahmed Johnson qualifying for King of the Ring. Who else qualified? Somebody else qualified, didn't they?
Who fought Hunter Hearst Helmsley? Was that
Ahmed? That was Ahmed. Who else? Maybe it was just one. I'm gonna check this out because I feel like I can't really continue without knowing this. I should be able to tell, but I talk about too much wrestling.
I have the bracket in my old notes. Let's see if I can.
No, nobody else fought yet, so we're fine. Basically, there's been one qualifier so far, and at this point, we also know that we're gonna have Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels at King of the Ring. But we kick off the show with Stone Cold Steve Austin. He comes out and he wants to make it clear that the only reason he saved Shawn Michaels last week was because it was another chance to beat up the Hart Foundation. But as Austin's kind of going, Shawn Michaels interrupts. Now, before we talk about what Shawn Michaels does here or what Steve Austin does, Sondra, please explain Shawn Michaels' outfit.
Okay, now, the main part of the outfit that I remember that Shawn Michaels was wearing was that bandana that he had tied around his head with the knot in front. And was he just wearing like jeans and a cutoff t-shirt or something as well?
You're being very kind to it being a cutoff t-shirt. It was a cutoff t-shirt that also was like a belly top.
Cut in multiple places.
He'd cut it like lengthwise and like cut the sleeves off, so he had made it into like, I'm trying to think of an example, I don't even know, like if you were watching California Dreams in 1992 and they went to the beach and there was like a jock on a jeep, he would have one of these Shawn Michaels tops on.
Actually, I could see Tiffany wearing something like this,
which is also a problem, but you know, that's Shawn Michaels for you.
Yeah. Oh, no, I just got to the spot in my notes. I took these notes like a week ago, so I barely remember what happened on this show. But Shawn Michaels is wearing a cutoff tank top and a headband and looks way different to his casual cool loafers look from before. Because I'm used to casual cool, like, slacks and loafers Shawn Michaels coming out with a chair. That's what he always does.
This guy looks like the son of the usual Shawn Michaels.
He looks like the teenage angsty son of the usual Shawn Michaels. Like, no, I'm going to rebel and do my hair different because you don't like it, Dad.
Do you know what baffles me beyond belief? Is that... So Shawn Michaels in 1997, right? This is so horrible to think about.
It is baffling, that's true.
Shawn Michaels at this point in 1997 is younger than I am right now.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
He does not look younger than us.
He turns 32 in July of 1997.
He looks so much older. I keep forgetting that Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart are such different ages, because I would say that they look to be of similar age. And Bret Hart is 40 here, right?
He turns
40 or 41.
He turns 40 on July 2nd of this year. But yeah, so he's 39 right now, but he turns 40 in like a month.
Right. Shawn Michaels definitely doesn't look that much younger. How old is Steve Austin here?
Steve Austin at this point... is, oh god, sorry, I typed it into Wikipedia and Steve Austria came up, who's US representative for Ohio's 7th congressional district.
Would not have known that.
We don't need him. Steve Austin at this point was 32 as well. Oh my god, Steve Austin was the same age as me here.
Oh no, we're gonna give Kenny another one of those age crises. So
how much they've accomplished by this point.
Yes,
I
know.
Accomplished.
You've accomplished plenty, shut your mouth. But what I think is funny is that Shawn Michaels has apparently reunited with all of the drugs, and maybe that's his motivation for this outfit, because it seems like he's trying a different cocktail today. He's a little more slurry, and his eyes seem glassier again, but he's also a little like, I don't know, I feel like he's added some uppers as well.
Do you know what the best thing is, though? The best thing of all is, do you know who right now is, at this point in Raw, is younger than me?
Doc
as
Hendricks?
I am right now. The fucking Undertaker.
Really? How old is the Undertaker? Oh, he would be, right? Because isn't he 51 now?
He was born in March of 1965. So he turned 32 in March. I turned 32 in January. The Undertaker is younger than me here. He's got Creatures of the Night. I've just got What Culture people.
He loves all of you who are listening to this, by the way.
I do, but you know, come on, Undertaker's accomplished more.
I feel like if your bar is The Undertaker, then
I think we were talking about off air. I need to really speed that up. That's going to get me going. That's going to get some steam. Anyway.
What a tease you are.
But I'll tell you how old Doc Hendricks is, because that's really what we care about.
That's really what we care about. Just so that we can baffle. We need to bring this up to Robert again, because he'll probably have forgotten by now.
Oh my god, right, hang on. I'm trying to work out dates here. Right, so Doc Hendricks here is 36 years old.
He looks so old.
Oh my god.
That's younger than Mr. Sandra is now.
Fucking hell. Anyway, so Shawn Michaels comes out. Away from my age crises. Shawn Michaels comes out now.
They never end, folks. They never end.
All right. I've been perfect over there in the corner. So Shawn Michaels comes out, and he is talking about how, you know, he's been around the WWF long before Steve Austin got there. Calls him son.
What I have written down is Shawn slurs plenty of things he did before Steve Austin got here.
Pretty much. And then they basically just start brawling out of nowhere. Owen Hart appears in the Titantron just laughing at them, which that was great.
I think a line I enjoyed from Shawn Michaels in particular was, "You're telling me, master of the sweet chin music, that you're going to kick my teeth down your throat?" He doesn't even notice.
Drugs.
All of them.
But Owen Hart issues a challenge to Stone Cold and Shawn Michaels to challenge for the tag team titles next week if they can get their crap together, because Owen Hart is not willing to say anything sweary.
I love him, by the way. I just love him being a dickhead. And I think it's very important to point out here, he offers Shawn Michaels and Steve Austin together a chance at the tag team championships. Just keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm. I do want to say very quickly right now, because I feel like David McCutcheon would be angry at me if I didn't mention it. Today in Calgary, they mentioned that congratulations to Jinder Mahal becoming the first Calgarian to become a WWE champion in 20 years. Owen
really?
Hart didn't get there. Owen Hart didn't get it, folks. Owen Hart. Just saying. So, Owen Hart, who is great.
I'm not rising to your bait. We'll discuss it on the SmackDown.
You don't
summary.
Need to rise to it. It's fact. Owen Hart didn't.
No, it is a fact. It is a fact. It's just the vitriol about it. I just... That's fine. Go on.
I know it's fine. Thank you. So, Owen Hart challenges Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels to a match for the tag team titles. And they basically don't want to team up with each other, so they both intend to go and find their own partners. Now, I don't know what exactly the outcome was going to be if they both turned up with other tag team partners, like who would get the preferential tag title shot. I don't know. But the big news is Sondra, next week Shawn Michaels will be back in action, and that's all that matters, really, isn't it?
Oh, clearly. I'm very excited to see that.
So up next, we have a King of the Ring qualifier. So basically, Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels are going away to try and find separate tag team partners. There's no clarity as to why this is allowed, but fine.
It doesn't make any sense to me. Like, from the start, I was like, but he didn't offer you guys each individually a tag team title shot. The reason that Owen Hart, dickhead of the world, who wants to keep all of his belts, would offer them a tag title shot is because they can't get their crap together, right? And he knows that they're not going to work together, so he thinks it will be funny and a way to be like, look, we defended our tag team titles, but... these two just couldn't work together, so ha ha ha, and it's a way to get back at Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels and piss them off. He didn't offer them a chance at the tag titles because he's being super valiant and is like, yes, we really want to defend these belts in two different matches, one with Steve Austin and a partner and another with Shawn Michaels and a partner. That's not the stipulation here.
No, it's not. I don't know why this was allowed or why we're going along with it, but we are, so fair enough. So up next, we're supposed to have Crush in a match for a King of the Ring qualifier. It was going to be against Vader, but Vader's nose is broken from the Ken Shamrock match at Cold Day in Hell. So we cut back to Gerald Briscoe, who apparently now is going to be the person to tell us what's going on. Why, I don't know. Why not Gorilla Monsoon? Why not Vince McMahon? Why not Jim Ross? Gerald Briscoe? Fair enough.
Can I read exactly what he says?
Please do.
Because I wrote it down because it was so bad. Well, last week in the pre-match instructions given by referee Timmy White, he erred by informing Hunter Hearst Helmsley that he could only advance by pinfall or submission. Therefore, to avoid any legal action on the part of Mr. Helmsley, Hunter Hearst Helmsley will be given the slot tonight occupied by Vader against the match Crush, his opponent.
Makes sense to me.
I mean... It seems like one of those things where it's like you had a sentence, you had phrases that were all worked out, and then, like, I don't know, the dog got a hold of your homework or something and chewed it up, so you tried to tape it back together, but it didn't quite work, and so everything got a bit jumbled, but you kind of still get the point.
Yeah, well, I actually, in theory, I like the story. Like, I like the idea that, like, Helmsley wasn't told the correct rules, so he found the loophole to, like, get in there. I like that.
Oh, I like that. It makes Hunter Hearst Helmsley seem like a dick. I mean, he was eliminated, and I just like the fact that it's to avoid any legal action as well, because, of course, they're worried about legal action from the rich Connecticut boy. So, yeah, apparently, I was like, so I guess he thought a DQ wouldn't eliminate him, and he thought that these matches were no holds barred or something, so that's why he hit Ahmed with the chair and kind of, you know, went for that. But now we have to watch Hunter Hearst Helmsley fight Crush. Like, does anyone want to see that match? Because I sure didn't.
So we get Hunter Hearst Helmsley versus Crush. Doesn't go too long, thankfully. But in the end, you know, China obviously always gets involved in every single match because it's China. But
of course,
Savio Vega like hops up in the apron when Hunter's trying for the pedigree. So China's raging, obviously, and she. Tries to get involved, and then the ref tries to get China off the apron, and Savio and Crush are trying to, like, you know, Crush is trying to get Helmsley for Savio to kick him, and then Savio kicks Crush by mistake, And then that causes Crush to lose. So Hunter Hearst-Helmsley gets the pedigree, gets the victory. So he advances, even though he lost last week. And the bet that, so he advances in the King of the Ring tournament, which is great. And, you know, there's dissension amongst the nation with this. But the absolute best part of this is that, do you know who Hunter Hearst-Helmsley advances to face in the semi-finals at King of the Ring?
I don't. Is it Goldust?
No, it's Ahmed Johnson.
Are you serious? So we get that big rematch, huh?
Yeah. So Savio obviously kicks Crush by mistake, and then Savio and Crush start arguing. They're clearly about to come to blows, but Farouk comes out and sort of handles his business.
When Farouk is the voice of reason here.
What did you think of the whole, putting Helmsley back? Cause there's a lot kind of to unpack here from this. Is Helmsley back in the match? The whole kind of, you know, story of him threatening legal action. Then there's Savio inadvertently costing Crush the match. Dissension amongst the nation, Farouk coming out for the save. Break it down for me, Sandra.
I definitely didn't expect it. I mean, last week I was actually kind of surprised that Ahmed Johnson, Hunter Hearst-Helmsley would have been a first round match, because Hunter Hearst-Helmsley seems like someone that they would go on to do big things with. I mean, later in the year, there's a pay-per-view called Degeneration X, right? Like, I know that. So I was kind of surprised that he got out so quickly. And it's interesting because I didn't know, looking at the bracket last week, who wins this King of the Ring. And now I think I know who wins this King of the Ring. And it's weird. But, I don't know. Just it was an interesting story for sure. Like, I mean, was it supposed to legitimately be Crush versus Vader? Or did they have plans to put Hunter back in somehow against someone and this just worked out?
See, I've been trying to find this out because it's tough to talk about because I can't say it, because there's always plans. I think the idea was for Vader to be in the match. And I think that's why they came up with the idea of putting Helmsley back in it. But, it all seems a bit strange anyway, no matter what they were going to do. Like, why?
Or did they know that this was the plan last week when they eliminated him? And they had, like, did they know that Vader wasn't going to be back at the point when they had Hunter lose to Ahmed Johnson in the first place? It's just, I don't know. The whole thing is just really strange. I'm kind of into it, I guess. And I'd rather it be Hunter Hearst-Helmsley than Crush, obviously. But I'd rather it be Vader than either of them.
Yeah, no, that's yeah, no, I don't know exactly. I think this is a conversation to have after King of the Ring, to be honest, because it's hard for me to have the full conversation right now.
Am I right though? Am I right about who wins it?
Who do you think wins it?
Hunter Hearst-Helmsley.
Yes. Okay, so we'll have the conversation now. So the thing is, Helmsley was supposed
because
to win.
Like, when I looked at the bracket at first, nothing rang a bell, and I was like, oh good, I've forgotten who won King of the Ring, and I saw, you know, Hunter got eliminated, and da da da. And as soon as he came back in, I'm like, oh, I've heard people talk about this before. And I know that also last year he was supposed to win King of the Ring, and then the curtain call happened, and there was all that, and mm-hmm. And so he didn't win, and then it clicked in my mind watching this episode. I was like, oh right, he does actually win it this year. So,
yeah, so yeah,
I do know that.
So he was supposed to obviously win last year, which I think is one of the most fascinating things. And, you know, we've covered WWF since the night after Mind Games, which is September 23rd, 1996. But right. In 1996 and 1997, so many things happened that caused Steve Austin to just get more momentum and more momentum and more momentum. You know, like, just off the top of my head, you know, if the curtain call hadn't happened, Hunter would have won King of the Ring. Austin wouldn't have won it. He wouldn't have got to cut the Austin 316 promo. If Bret Hart hadn't have agreed to come back and not gone to WCW, Austin wouldn't have had the Bret Hart program, which elevated him. They were going to have Bret Hart win the Royal Rumble, but everybody knew he was going to win the Royal Rumble, so they changed the finish and had Austin win it, which elevated Austin. If Shawn hadn't lost his smile in February, then Austin would not have been in the match with Bret at WrestleMania. You know, so there's all these things that have happened that have really helped him elevate, you know. And I'm not saying, like, I think everybody kind of agrees that he would have become a star anyway, but I don't know, like, I feel there's so many things that really helped him. Like, there's like a sort of like chain of things that happened.
I feel like Steve Austin is the most interesting case study for the fact that you can't just create in a sterile environment the best wrestling stories or the best wrestling stars. And you can't necessarily, I mean, you can do everything right, and sometimes things just still aren't going to work out. And sometimes when things go wrong, sometimes when things go, you know, completely wrong and completely against your plans, sometimes that's where the best things come out of them. And I think that's just part of wrestling as an organic storytelling medium kind of a thing, right? Like, you can't create it in a bubble. You have to deal with crowd responses. You have to always be kind of, you know, giving something to the crowd, but also listen to what they're giving you. And I think when it's kind of a symbiotic relationship is when it's best, and when you're willing to change your mind, or when you're willing to alter plans because things aren't going as planned. And I think Steve Austin's just kind of the most interesting case study for that. Daniel Bryan is the other one for me. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I've been watching in my fandom, because Daniel Bryan wasn't supposed to get to where he was, but because of all sorts of circumstances that you can't create, you just, sometimes they just happen. And if you go with them, then they can be beautiful. And if you try to not go with them, then that's when I think wrestling starts to feel flat, is when it's, you know, what, more one-sided than the other.
Yeah, and I think the two things that I'm noticing watching these Raws back is that the wrestling today is far superior, without question. There's no doubt about the wrestling today being much better. But I think that what they did better then was that they would allow, if something didn't quite go, if something was supposed to happen and it didn't happen, they would go with something else and see how it worked out. And it wouldn't be a case of, like, if they went with something else, they would curb it and go back to the thing they wanted to do. Like, mm-hmm. things would change. And I think that was, there's an organicness to that that would, I think if they applied that to today with the wrestling we have today, could just blow things up. You know?
Yeah, I agree. Because, like, I mean, I would still rather watch wrestling today than wrestling back then in general. Like, I would rather watch the shows today, except for, you know, the length of Raw is a problem. But yeah, I mean, like, for instance, Braun Strowman's injury has really bummed me out, because I was really hoping that they were going to actually go with Braun Strowman as a guy to, you know, do things in the next couple months. And now, you know, unfortunately, it's one of those situations where things can't always be controlled and you kind of need to find other plans. But, like, Braun Strowman, no one expected him to get as popular as he was. Like, I don't think Braun Strowman was planned to be the guy who would remind me so much of Stone Cold Steve Austin from 20 years ago, but he did. And it seemed like they were kind of willing to go with it. I mean, the plan was Braun Strowman versus Brock Lesnar, which doesn't seem like it would have been the plan a year ago for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, it's just one of those. And what's also fascinating is that there's more and more you find comparisons to 1997 people to now, which is always interesting. You know, like Braun mm-hmm. Strowman being the new Steve Austin or whatever. So just to finish off on Vader, it was written in The Observer with his injuries that his nose was broken in four places, including a broken septum. But it's the nose that's really keeping him out of action. He did have thigh and knee injuries, but they weren't really a problem. But he couldn't breathe well enough through the nose, and that's why he had to go out and have it fixed, which is why he's been out. So, just so we know why Vader's away.
I mean, Ken Shamrock was definitely kicking the shit out of Vader in that match. It's not that shocking that he came away with some injuries. It's unfortunate. I mean, I can see why Vader was like, ease up!
Yeah, exactly. Up next, though, we have Owen Hart come out. And he basically has everything. He has slammies, he has the tag belt, he has the IC belt. He is so happy at all the gold that he has. He's so glorious. He comes out, he's with Davey Boy and Jim Neidhart. And then, if we were not aware already, Sandra, this is in Mobile, Alabama. And,
right.
And we cut to some wrestling fans giving Bob Holly some pre-match encouragement.
Yes, there's a child called Donnie Dees.
But then, the best thing is Jerry Lawler. Oh, God, it's so good. Jerry Lawler doesn't feel this is the true representation of Alabama. So he interviews two people who appear to be some sort of inbreed thing. Because they are just mental. Like they, and then he keeps making jokes at them, and they don't get that he's making jokes about them, so they agree with the jokes.
They don't get it at all. He asked this one guy who I think was called James Dees. So I'm wondering if he was related to Donnie Dees from outside. That's my question.
But just for people who haven't watched it, Jerry Lawler is in the middle of these two absolute buffoons. Continue.
Right, they are absolute buffoons. And this, like, skinny man with really awful glasses, Jerry Lawler's like, if you and your wife got divorced, would she still be your sister or something? And this just seems to confuse the man. He's just kind of like...
Because he doesn't know the answer to this.
Like, he has no idea what Lawler is even saying.
I don't know. It's...
He's just... He just kind of has this dumb grin on his face, like, uh-huh, sure, why not? And Lawler's like, these are real Alabamians. He says Alabamians. And...
I was younger, I used to think that's what they were called. Listen, if Jerry Lawler tells me they're Alabamians, that's what I think they are.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, Jerry Lawler would never lie.
No. Heels don't lie, Sandra.
No, never, ever would they do such a thing. But yeah, this whole, like, Mobile, Alabama, wishing Bob Holly luck, and a woman's like, being from Mobile makes us tough, and... You know, all of these things. There are mad USA chants for Bob Holly. Everyone seems to love him there.
But do you know what's fascinating about this? Is because, so Bob Holly's facing Owen Hart, and Bob Holly comes out, non-title match, obviously.
Right.
And the fans are fucking behind him, because what they do here is they give you a match with a hometown guy against the Intercontinental Champion. They have, you know, Owen kind of like trying to dispose of him. Holly gets a move in and people are really into it. And in the end, Bob Holly, like, basically as Owen tries to go for the sharpshooter, Bob Holly counters it into an inside cradle, gets the win. Owen has the best tantrum of all time. And
the Hart Foundation is so angry.
And the Bulldog and Jim Neidhart run down to try and get to Bob Holly. Bob Holly jumps the guardrail, and Bob Holly's pinned the IC champion. But, like, what they did was, and it's something that they've not done in a long time, and I'm not even talking about today, I'm talking about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, is they have this thing now in hometowns where they want to, like, fuck people.
And yeah, like, Bob Holly wins in his hometown. That's something that shocked me on this show.
Yeah, and he, like, you know, I mean, obviously we're not building to, like, a Bob Holly pay-per-view program, but it means, like, you know, next time they come back to Alabama, they could do Bob Holly Owen Hart, and people are into it, because they did a TV thing, and I don't think it hurt Owen Hart here that he lost, because he underestimated Bob Holly, and he paid for it. Simple. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it didn't look like a, you know, definitive, oh, Bob Holly is so superior to Owen Hart situation. It was one of those, oh, he got super lucky on an inside cradle situations and then ran away afterward. To the sounds of his Vroom Vroom music, which I find delightful, by the way. His music is amazing.
Which I'm going to play at the end of the podcast, because it is excellent.
Yes, because it's, yeah, it's excellent music. But, I mean... there's something to winning in your hometown, right? Like, it makes the crowd happy. It makes them feel good. And I don't know, when did WWE start doing this whole everyone loses in their hometowns thing? Because since I've started watching, I can't recall that many victories in hometowns. And when I've seen them, they seem surprising. Like, I remember Beth Phoenix losing to Kelly Kelly in Albany, New York.
Oh, God.
That was, I think, my first... moment that I remember thinking clearly, this is her hometown and she just lost and that sucks, especially because it was supposed to be like she lost in her hometown and everyone's behind her, and Kelly Kelly was supposed to be the baby face and was also awful, but I digress.
Like, Kelly, when did the worst human
she's terrible, but when did they start doing this thing where, I mean, does Vince McMahon just find it hilarious to make people lose in their hometowns? Like, I know Naomi got to win in Orlando, which was cool. But it doesn't happen very often.
The first thing I really remember of hometown embarrassment, anyway, was in a few years from now, JR gets embarrassed in Oklahoma. And I remember
I've heard about this, yeah.
So I remember that being the first time where, like, there's not a lot of things, but there's one thing that happens to JR and Raw that I actively don't enjoy watching. Like, I just think it's cruel, and it really bothers me. So stuff like that began to happen, and that was 2001. So I don't know. I mean, I feel like when we watch these shows, we're probably gonna actually figure it out. You know, we're probably gonna get to where that first thing is. So I don't know, but
yeah, it was just interesting knowing that 20 years ago they didn't necessarily have that, right? Like,
no,
you actually have Bob Holly winning in his hometown, basically just because it's his hometown. I mean, this wouldn't have worked with anyone else quite as well as it did with a guy from Mobile, Alabama, who could pin Owen Hart and then get the crowd super behind him. And it made the Hart Foundation look like super, I don't know, petulant? because they threw such a tantrum afterwards, which was beautiful. I loved it. I love the Heart Foundation.
They are great. So we go from that to we have Shawn Michaels backstage with Ken Shamrock. Shamrock has basically been talked into being Shawn Michaels' tag team partner.
I feel like you're missing a very important segment.
Am I?
Yes. Well, I mean, first of all, The Undertaker talked about, I don't know, some stuff from last week. It was, I think, the same stuff from last week. Everyone has secrets, blah, blah, blah. Like, no one really cares. But you're missing out on Sonny's search and soak mission.
Oh, God. Yes. Sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. So, apparently, this is all sponsored by Super Soakers, right? As Sonny says, wetter is...
Well, this is the Jim Cornette Super Soaker.
This is the Jim Cornette thing. Jim Cornette knocks on Sonny's door, and he says that he has contracts or something, and if she doesn't sign them, she'll be all washed up. And then she sprays Jim Cornette with a Super Soaker, and he sells it like a champ. Like, this is the worst thing that could possibly happen to him.
I need someone who listens to this podcast who is... I don't know how to, like, rip video stuff. I'm very bad at it. Somebody please rip this Sonny Jim Cornette Super Soaker thing for me so I can send it to him and make fun of him. Please. Because I really want to send it to him and I don't know how...
Is it not on YouTube anywhere?
No, I couldn't find it. So if anybody knows how to get it off the network, please do so because it's very funny. And he will roll his eyes. So maybe I'll make me...
Like, I know how to do it, but my computer's too slow and it never processes well.
Okay.
Which is not shocking.
No, it's not, given that we waited an hour and a half to do this.
Yes.
But yeah, we do get Sonny. I mean, I feel like Jim Cornette is the perfect person for this. I do want to tell you something about Sonny, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Which I think is going to make you really unhappy. But it makes me laugh. So, on Shotgun Saturday Night, which is happening around this time, so, for people who are in the US, I don't know if you'll find this interesting, but I'll tell you anyway. In the UK, we used to get Shotgun on a Saturday afternoon. And it was called Shotgun. That's it. No Saturday night, just Shotgun.
Because it was Saturday afternoon, and that would make no sense at all.
Bingo. But we would not get the North American commentary, which I didn't know at the time. I would find it years later. We would basically get like a UK international version of it, which would have the matches that happened that are taped at Raw. But we wouldn't get everything. So we wouldn't get like the Sonny in bed segments and all that sort of stuff. Unbeknownst to me, for a lot of 1997, the commentary team were Jim Ross and Brian Pillman. So I'm actually going to make a point of trying to get the set so I can start watching Pillman and JR because I want to hear them in commentary. And on the May 18th version, the May 17th, Shotgun Saturday Night, which was the night before this one, we had... Basically, Sonny told Mankind at one point in the show, I won't bite. And Brian Pillman came back on commentary with, she won't bite, but she'll certainly swallow. And JR had to come in apparently straight away and go, her pride! Immediately. Because JR could not allow this line to go out on commentary.
Oh, good so, save, JR.
I actually want to seek this episode out just to hear how it plays out. But I love the idea of like Sonny being like, I won't bite! And then Brian Pillman being like, she won't bite, but she'll certainly swallow. Her pride, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back after this commercial message. Like, it just makes me laugh how that would all take place. So that's a Sonny
story. If it were anyone but Sonny, I would be super upset with that line. But it's Sonny, so I can't even be that mad. Like, I hate lines like that about women because I feel like those types of lines are said about women way too often just as an insult. But it is Sonny, to be fair.
I mean, that's kind of like trying to argue... I can't even come up with comparisons for Sonny.
She's just such a cretin of a human.
Anyway, so we get a Super Soaker Jim Cornette and Sonny ad.
Love him sitting on the ground all like soaked from the Super Soaker, just like, you know, pouting and going like, nah, I'm wet now and I hate it. And he's like shaking his head back and forth and it's great. I love the Sonny search and soak mission. I want to know what the actual mission was though. I mean, Jim Cornette knocked on her door. It's not like she was actively looking for him.
I mean, she was ready for him, I'm just saying.
She was. She was definitely prepared.
So Shawn Michaels is backstage with Ken Shamrock. Shawn Michaels has managed to get Ken Shamrock to agree to be his partner. Sean feels that he can trust Ken Shamrock, and then Ken says he'll take care of Davey Boy Smith if Sean will take care of Owen. So they seem like a cohesive unit, Sandra, so nothing can go wrong. Unless Steve Austin finds a partner, which we'll come back to.
Which was great. But at this point, I was just like, why is this an option? I don't think Owen meant for this to happen. This was not the stipulation as presented. The stipulation as presented was not Shawn Michaels, you go find a partner. Steve Austin, you go find a partner. And then I'll defend my titles twice. The stipulation was Shawn Michaels, Steve Austin, you don't get along. You guys can get a title shot if you can get your crap together. It just infuriated me this whole episode that no one was paying attention to what Owen had actually said.
But you know what's interesting as I was thinking about this was the thing about Retro Raw that I think that we give it a lot of credit for is that they do weave a lot of storylines in together, and they do seem to pay a lot more attention to storylines. Which I actually think is a testament to how good the stories were at this point that we actually feel so strongly about this one.
Mm-hmm.
Because like this is the first time I feel like in a long time where we've been like, why is this not being brought up? Because it usually, like, we compliment how they bring things up that we wouldn't even think they need to bring up, you know? So, it's
yeah, it usually makes a lot more sense. That's true. It does get rectified, but...
It does get rectified, but...
I was just infuriated throughout the entirety of the episode until it is rectified, because I was like, no!
It's very fair. Up next, we have a match. We've had the sit down interviews with Goldust and Marlena in the last couple of weeks, so now Jim Ross is sitting down with Mankind. And they show you some footage of his Dude Love days, his childhood stories, him as a kid, being kicked in the lip and bleeding all over his sweatshirt, eating worms, all this sort of stuff. And a lot of it was kind of like, you know, surface level stuff. Just to kind of build the Mankind character. But they kind of tease that next week they're going to discuss more about Dude Love and the evolution of him becoming Cactus Jack. So I just kind of wanted to ask you, actually, with the Goldust promos we've had the last couple of weeks and then the Mick Foley one here, how effective are these for you as a viewer who has seen these characters for about 9 months now and they've not really had a lot of character development? And now they're attempting some character development. Is it working? What parts are working? What parts aren't? And do you think any of this stuff could be transferred to today and help any of today's characters?
I love these kind of vignettes and these kind of interviews. I think they're fascinating. And I think that they absolutely could be transferred to today. In fact, I think that some of the aspects of what they're doing here have been transferred to today. If you look at the Roderick Strong vignettes in NXT, I don't think they're doing stuff like this on the main roster right now, but I think it would be great if they did. It's stuff like, I mean, they did the ones in NXT again with Finn Balor, you know, and all of his Legos and, you know, going behind the scenes with Finn Balor and letting you know a little bit more about him and, you know, why he wants to be the demon. The whole thing was like the demon gives him strength because he's a shy guy and doesn't necessarily, you know, like feel like himself, but when he's the demon and when he goes out there and wrestles, then that gives him confidence, right? I feel like it's the same kind of thing with Mankind and with Goldust. They're building the person behind the character. And that's something I find really fascinating about it is that it's 1997 and they're making a very big distinction between the person and the character. But with these Mankind ones, they're managing to bring Mick Foley's real life and real childhood and, you know, stories from his past into how he became Mankind, kind of. Like, they're not going into the nitty-gritty details of, like, so why are you wearing a leather mask exactly? Because how did you become this guy? But they have him talking about, you know, how, you know, kids played cowboys and Indians, and the cowboys were supposed to be the good guys, and the Indians were supposed to be, you know, the savage bad guys. And I've always hated that game anyway because it's kind of stupid, right? It's like, yeah, the good guys are the ones who come and rape and pillage and take the land from the people that were already there. And so then you have Mankind saying, I was always the Indian, Jimmy. I always stood for the underdog. And it's fascinating because I'm like, yeah, that's who I always related to too, because I always thought the cowboys were assholes. So I kind of like Mankind. And he talks about being in elementary school and playing a game of kill the guy with the ball. And, you know, talking about how he was bleeding and he was in pain and he was loving it because he finally found something he could do better than anyone else. And that was handle pain. And then, you know, talking about when he ate a worm, but then people in their cliques like ganged up on him and talks about people like throwing worms at him, and the story became Mick Foley eats a plate full of worms every day instead of just like he ate a worm because of, you know, whatever. Because when people were throwing worms at him, the whole story was he wanted to show them that they weren't hurting him. They were hurting his pride. So we ate the biggest worm and showed them that they couldn't hurt him by doing this to him. And, you know, the story evolved and it changed and became like he is super, super weird. And this vignette just makes me feel bad for Mankind, really. It doesn't make him feel like a heel at all. So I don't know if this is actually part of a babyface turn or what. And I've seen this interview before because I've heard of the Mankind interviews with JR, and I've seen them on, you know, I own a couple of Mick Foley DVDs, and I'm sure that one or both of the interviews is on one of the DVDs that I own.
The idea of these vignettes is to turn him babyface.
Okay, well, that's what it should be, because that's exactly what it's doing. I mean, you know,
isn't
saying,
it funny there that what's happening here is there's a desired effect and it's taking place?
Like, well, yeah, no, know? It's great. Like, it's absolutely what should happen. I find Mick Foley a lot more of a babyface character right now than I even find Steve Austin at this point.
Do you know who I know that JR signed a, I know we're talking about retro stuff, but, you know, sometimes it comes into current stuff. JR obviously signed a new contract with WWE. What I would like to see is JR sit down with someone like a Bray Wyatt.
I think that'd be great.
And go into some... Because if you look at Mankind and Bray Wyatt are not too dissimilar in the sense of, like, you know, they're the first kind of year or so, Mankind wasn't like a real person. You know, he was like a really fictional character and blah, blah, blah. Whereas when you put the real aspects in there, it humanized him, and that humanization of him made him more relatable, and he became a bigger star because of it. So I wonder if, you know, putting Bray Wyatt in there and sort of saying, you know, you had to come out of the shadows of Mike Rotunda and IRS and all that, if really sort of like use Jim Ross for this kind of stuff, because I feel like this is where he really thrives. I wonder if somebody like a Bray Wyatt wouldn't flourish through something like that.
Yeah, it would be interesting. I mean, it'd be super interesting, actually. I would love to see it. Except, I mean, the only reason I don't want Bray Wyatt to do it is that I still hold on to my canon of the Bray Wyatt character, right? And I'm like, no, but his father wasn't IRS. His father was an evil shrimp boat captain. But I understand that that is from an FCW vignette years ago, and maybe I just have to let it go. but
perhaps,
I mean,
Sandra, I'm not going to tell you what to do.
Perhaps. I still hold on to it. I still think it's an interesting part of Bray Wyatt's character. But no, you're right. I mean, I think JR would be very effective at that, because he was very good here. He was very good here talking to Mankind. Not that there's any doubt that he would be.
And
but
we're going to pick up again next week with it. We've got more to come and kind of see.
I'm excited to see more of it.
Then we go to a weird match where it's Leaf Cassidy facing Scott Taylor. Now, Jerry Law talks about how Rob Van Dam was supposed to be here tonight, but Paul Heyman.
The lowlife, Paul E. Heyman.
Paul E. Dangerously has, you know, done some sort of legal thing which has kept RVD off of tonight's Raw. RVD, who you can see as part of the 128-man wrestling tournament as part of Five Star Wrestling. They have currently about 10 men confirmed, so only 118 to still be announced. One of whom may be CM Punk, who they have offered $1 million. Sorry, $1 million for that. So keep abreast of that. And sure.
I'm sure that'll go very well for them.
So RVD was supposed to be on the show, he's not. So we see some highlights of him and Jeff Hardy from last week.
Lawler calls RVD the only piece of talent ever in ECW.
So we get Leaf Cassidy versus Scott Taylor. I'm going to ask you this. I'm not insulting you, but you know who Scott Taylor is, right?
I don't. He looks familiar, and I'm not sure why.
Scott Taylor would go on to be known universally as Scotty Too Hottie as part of Too Cool.
Okay, gotcha. Like, I actually had written down, he looks familiar, and I'm not sure why. So I knew that he was someone that I was supposed to know who he was, probably, and I almost texted you to ask, but then didn't. Okay, gotcha.
I don't know if you knew
that's the worm guy.
That's the worm guy. Not the worm guy that we just saw in a set.
Not the guy who eats worms, but the worm guy. Yeah.
So I don't know if you know this, but at this point, WWF are planning a light heavyweight division. Part of what they were doing at this point was they were trying to work out a deal with like Michinoku Pro Wrestling in Japan and Mexico, and try and like work out to get some people to come in for that. So Scott Taylor would be someone who would be involved in that division, not necessarily a top guy or anything, but he would be somebody that they could use in that division. So he's kind of on TV here. He's been a job guy for a while on WWF television. He would wrestle on shows like Wrestling Challenge and Superstars. But he's here to sort of further this Leaf Cassidy story of Leaf Cassidy going crazy, because Scott Taylor ends up small packaging Leaf Cassidy and getting a win. Leaf Cassidy then, again, grabs Jim Ross and erupts because he lost, and does like the Chris Jericho gimmick of getting angry because he lost, but before Chris Jericho did it, even though Chris Jericho kind of did it better, and that's the one that's remembered.
Right. But he's like, I can't take it anymore, and he grabs JR, and, you know, JR just comes back with, then get some help.
JR's reactions to Leaf Cassidy are one of my favorite things.
It's great. I love his reactions to Leaf Cassidy.
Going back, he's an idiot. Jim Ross.
Just like, get this guy out of my way. I cannot be bothered. No, Lawler spends the entirety of this match making fun of Scott Taylor's mom for working in a convenience store.
I mean, to be honest, if you're going to make fun of Scott Taylor for anything, his hair would be what I would make fun of him for.
His hair is incredible, isn't it?
And it's because, like, he becomes very famous for a very silly hairstyle. But who would have thought that a hairstyle that is silly would be miles better than what this hairstyle is?
The funniest part about this, right, is that I always picture Scotty Too Hotty as bald. Because the first time I saw Scotty Too Hotty was at NXT Arrival against The Ascension, and he had shaved his head, and that is how I always picture him.
Who did he team with again?
It was Too Cool.
Did Brian Cross come out of there?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
Because William Regal had to say Grandmaster Sexay, and then just could not handle it. He was like, I can't believe I'm saying these words.
Yeah, like JR saying sexy is not. I always remember that thing where Michael Cole brought Grandmaster Sexay back and he danced down to the ring to zero reaction.
When he was like trying to say that, you know, Jerry Lawler, you don't even acknowledge your son? Because that was right when I started watching wrestling. I had no idea who he was. And Alaric was like, that's his son, but he doesn't like to talk about it or something.
Yeah, and then it cuts to Michael Cole in the ring dancing to Banging It Up by Too Cool, which is one of my favorite things.
Yeah, I remember that segment, actually.
So we then cut to Steve Austin back. Now, Steve Austin's a very intelligent individual, but this is not his cleverest moment. He's looking for a tag team partner, and he decides to walk into Sable's dressing room. And Sable, of course, is getting changed.
For what? What is she changing for?
The great part of this is she's getting changed and she's raging that he's come in. And he's like trying to find a tag team partner. But
then lock your door! Lock the door if you're changing!
The funny thing is, though, is she's changing into an Austin 316 t-shirt, which is my favorite part of it.
Well, none of this makes any sense, right? Okay, like, why is Sable changing? We don't know. She's not on the rest of the show, so what even is she doing there? Why does she have her own dressing room? I don't know. She's not that important. Like, also, then she uses the Austin 316 shirt to cover her tits, but just doesn't put the shirt on. It takes just as much effort to just put the shirt on as it does to hold the shirt up and go, get out of here, get out of here. Yeah.
But if she was to put the shirt on, a tit would slip out.
No, it wouldn't. I know how shirts work and I know how tits work. There's and if no you put way, the shirt on, they're covered.
There's no way she could have put that full shirt on without any tit slippage.
Well, I mean, if you turn around and don't face the camera, there's going to be a moment where, yes, your tits are exposed, but no one can see them.
Oh, okay, okay, got you.
If you just turn around, like, and plus, if you have the shirt mostly over your tits anyway, then you can, there's a way to kind of, like, sneak your head and your arms through it without actually having to uncover at all. Trust me, I spent years changing in girls' locker rooms for gym class. We have figured this shit out.
It's this kind of analysis that you listen to us for.
I'm just saying.
We then
women will back me up on this.
I don't doubt it. Give me in trouble for. I didn't walk into Sable's dressing room, try to get her to be my tag team partner.
No, Steve Austin did, and he lingered.
I'm the one that was doing a walk through Access last year and said the reason you've not, and when I saw a Brock Lesnar poster said, "Ah, oh, the reason you've not seen Zabel for the last 5 years is because she can't walk. She fucks Brock Lesnar."
That's right. I forgot about that.
Still stand by it. Bret Hart arrives at the building. He's not in his wheelchair anymore. He's got crutches, so at least he's getting better. We get the pyro and video package for hour two.
They even do the worldwide leader in sports entertainment.
Now, did
thing.
You notice that when I've been meaning to bring this up, but I've forgotten. When they do this whole, like, you know, in over 50 countries, in 7 different languages, so over 500 million viewers each week, the World Wrestling Fair, and they go through the whole thing. At one point, you see Scotland come up in the country list.
So do you?
Yeah.
No, I didn't notice that, but...
I expect Yay. You to have a look for next week.
I will have a look for next week. Yay, Scotland.
So we kick off our two with Bret Hart. The Hart Foundation. Bret makes fun of Alabama, which, you know, fair.
I mean, I have good friends in Alabama, but also fair.
He announces that a real hero will be returning at King of the Ring, and that hero is Bret Hart. Bret challenges Shawn to the match, and Bret says that if he can't beat Shawn in less than 10 minutes, he'll never wrestle in the United States again. Shawn gets the Titantron and says that Bret couldn't beat him in 60, much less 10. Good line. Fair point.
Mm-hmm.
Shawn says he'll wrestle Bret if he agrees that the other 4 Hart Foundation guys were handcuffed to each ring post. Shawn wants to settle things once and for all. And then Shawn goes on to say that Bret couldn't go 10 minutes in any situation. Wink, wink. And then
I think he means sexually.
I think so. Bret's been having some sunny days recently, but he still can't get the job done. And Bret agrees to the stipulation and can't wait to smoke Shawn. Weird line.
Which also just sounds really sexual in this context.
It does. It sounds like Sonny's double teaming them. I don't want to get into it. Shawn,
it kind of does.
Shawn thinks that Bret has a snowball's chance in hell of beating him in less than 10 minutes. And that's kind of it. So I'm curious for you, as someone who's kind of started watching, like, through what we've seen so far, do you want to see Shawn and Bret at King of the Ring? Does it feel like the story has been built enough for you to want to see it? Or has the kind of stop and start of the storyline hurt the desire to watch it?
I think the stop and start has hurt it. I mean, it seems like every time they build to Shawn Michaels versus Bret Hart, something else interrupts it and it seems better than Shawn Michaels versus Bret Hart. So I'm just sort of waiting for something more interesting to happen, I guess. And I don't know, like the whole stipulation of every, you know, all of the Hart Foundation having to be handcuffed to a ring post. I don't see that going well for Shawn. It doesn't seem like the most intelligent stipulation. It seems like having them banned from ringside or having them all have to like be in a cage off screen or whatever, not a cage above the ring. Cause we all know that's stupid because they're going to drop a weapon in, but having them all like handcuffed up on the stage where they're not next to the ring, that seems like it would be smarter. I think the drugs have gotten to Shawn Michaels, and I don't think the stipulation is very smart, because if they're all handcuffed to a ring post, that means they're still there ringside and they can still grab your leg or grab your ankle. Like, I just don't see this going well for Shawn.
But I mean, it is smart for him to kind of be like, we need to subdue them somehow.
It's smart for him to not want them to be able to interfere. What's not very smart is his solution. Like, if he would have thought this through a little bit without so many drugs. Like, maybe he should have taken different drugs.
Now, I'm not saying I've ever done this in my life. But say I'd taken MDMA, right? And I was out my face, right? I don't think I would have been able to think up a good solution. So I think Shawn's done well.
Well, I mean, fair enough. But I'm just saying that maybe if this is your one shot to beat Bret Hart, that dastardly guy who you really want to beat, like, maybe employ someone not on the use of drugs. Like, maybe have someone else think up a solution. You have friends. You're talking about your clique all the time.
But you can't.
I mean, I know most of them are druggy, too.
His whole clique's in WCW.
Yeah, true. But not Hunter Hearst Helmsley, who's the sober one.
But they're not pals on TV, though.
But I'm just saying backstage, you could have gone to him.
Got you. Okay.
And been like, so Hunter, like, I'm drugged out my nut, but like, I really need to come up with something. What do you got? You're going to be the cerebral assassin in a few years. I mean, I'm sure you can come up with a stipulation that's better than this. I mean, do you think that maybe that's what happened? And Hunter was like, well, one time I handcuffed a woman to the ring post and that seemed to go well for me. So maybe just go with that.
I wonder if how, like, can you imagine if somebody come up to like me in 1997 and like, Kenny, you know how Shawn Michaels is like the top guy and Hunter Hearst Helmsley hides behind a woman? Do you think that in 20 years, Hunter will be the boss of the company, married to Vince's daughter, and will be heralded as like the biggest star of all time within company folklore? I don't think I would have thought that was going to happen.
Yeah, no, probably not.
Which shows
not Hunter
you that Vince McMahon
really.
Is right, that anything can happen in the World Wrestling Federation.
It's so true. But, cool. I mean, I don't know, like, Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels, it's fascinating only because I know what's going on backstage and only because I'm waiting. I think I told you this before we started recording. I just keep waiting for segments to happen that I've seen ad nauseum whenever anyone talks about Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels. So I got to this and I saw Shawn on the Tron and I saw Bret in the ring and I was like, is this going to be the Sunny Days promo? Sure enough, it's a Sunny Days promo. And it didn't really affect me more than just to be like, all right, check, we're past that one now.
I guess also the thing that's interesting is that you know points that are going to happen. And also, you know that this match isn't going to happen at King of the Ring. So
right.
There's also a kind of a party that's going, well, what's the point in getting invested? Up next, we get Goldust versus Rockabilly. Goldust, obviously, is coming out of this whole two-week story of his real life and all that sort of stuff. We see footage of Goldust and Goldust and Marlena have Dakota, their daughter.
Dressed in gold. She's the little Marlena.
Yeah, that's weird.
Which is super weird, actually.
I mean, like, if your mum's dressed a bit provocatively, shall we say, dressing your child that way, is the thing is, I feel like if you're at home,
well, it's not like they got Dakota's tits out or anything. I mean, they had her in
had
a nice
some.
Respectable goal. She's three.
That's what I mean. If they had some, they would have fucking exploited it. That was the
yeah, they probably would have, but I mean, she is 3 years old here, but
she's
I mean,
coming
they
out
her...
dressed like our mother who
well, I mean,
mother
but
is
they
dressed...
have her in a very adorable gold dress and it's cute, but it's also a little disturbing.
It's
disturbing. Yes, it's very strange. And then they hand Dakota the microphone, and it's kind of sweet because, you know, like the little girl, like she's a little girl and tiny humans are cute or whatever, I guess. So it's like, aw, you know, it's his daughter and that's kind of sweet. And they hand her the microphone and I forget what they want her to say, but she clearly has no idea what to say. But she's also three. So I don't know what you expected, right? Like,
listen, Maxwell's one, he did a delete chant, just saying.
Maxwell is a prodigy, though. Like, Maxwell's amazing. Dakota Runnels is no Maxwell Hardy.
I don't know if I've ever told this on the podcast, but, like, when we were in Glasgow, in the Classic Grand, there's, like, an upstairs bit where you can kind of just sit and watch the show, and Rebby and Maxwell were up at the top, and they were watching the show, and Matt started doing delete, and apparently as soon as he did delete, Maxwell just stood up and started doing the delete chants. Like, straight away.
He knows. He's been trained well.
Mm-hmm. But they take...
Also undefeated on Impact Television.
That's true. Never paid for his work.
Nope. Never even authorized. I don't think he was ever cleared to wrestle.
No, that's another fucking story. Dakota is taken backstage, though, so there's nothing weird. We get Rockabilly versus Goldust. Who gives a flying fuck?
I actually have written for the heading of this match in my notes, Goldust versus, it's Rockabilly.
But, Rockabilly.
Because they don't announce the matches beforehand, so I can't just write the headings. I always have to put, like, Goldust versus, and then make notes, and then go back and, you know, write it. So as soon as Rockabilly came out, I was just like, oh, for fuck's sake,
Rockabilly,
why?
Oh my, blah, blah, blah. Great song. Rockabilly gets his arm tied up in the ropes. Referee's trying to help him. Honky Tonk Man tries to hit Goldust. It fails. Honky Tonk Man gets hit with his own guitar. Referee DQs here. Which I'm not too sure why.
I'm not super sure either, because Goldust hits Honky Tonk Man with the guitar.
This is what I mean.
Why
are you disqualifying him for hitting a manager? That makes no sense to me.
It doesn't make sense. Honky Tonk Man was not a part of the match. Like, getting disqualified for hitting someone who's not in the match doesn't make any sense. I think it's because referees in 1997 seem even dumber than referees in 2017, which is not great. But we've had this before, though, right? Like, where someone just got up on the apron and the referee called for a DQ, but then, you know, you see someone hit someone else in the dick right in front of the referee, and they're like, that's fine.
Yep.
I feel like they need to have a referee meeting and go, okay, the rules of wrestling. Let's have a chat.
So yeah.
What I found most interesting in this match, and I use that term loosely because I don't think it was very interesting, but it was interesting enough to write down, is that Goldust was going back to a lot of his heel mannerisms here. Like, he's putting Rockabilly's hand on his ass and, like, kissing him as psychological tactics or whatever. I say that in inverted commas, like, psychological tactics. But he's still a babyface. I mean, he seemed a little bit more like an Exotico act in Lucha Libre, like the fun, happy babyface who might sexually molest you in a match or something.
Wow.
Well, what else would you call it?
I'm just saying, wow. So, Rockabilly gets a victory. Well, a cheap one.
He does.
Vince is wanting to talk to Ahmed Johnson about some of the stuff that Farouk was saying last week, which was controversial. Ahmed talks about, you know, he's not obviously not a fan of Farouk, given what they've went through. But he can't really argue with what Farouk had to say. Ahmed wants to make it clear that he's not a racist, which I don't think anyone thought that Ahmed Johnson was racist, but it's good that he clears it up.
Glad that he cleared it up.
But he does want to be the Hank Aaron of the WWF. Don't know what that means, but sure. Okay.
It's a really good baseball player.
Still don't know what that means, but sure.
That's as much as I can explain, because I don't remember what Hank Aaron did or what team he played for. Sorry, everyone who does sports.
Who does sports?
Or who knows sports better than I do.
But Ahmed says he wants to be the first black WWF champion. I thought it was quite a clever kind of thing of, like, you know, obviously Ahmed and Farouk hate each other, but there is kind of like a thread of, like, the racism thing. So Ahmed can be the babyface guy who wants to be the first black WWF champion. Farouk can be the heel guy who wants to be the first black WWF champion, and they can kind of fight each other for who that can be.
I actually really liked Ahmed here. I liked that Ahmed was pissed about the question, because Vince wants to ask about Farouk playing the race card. They say the race card so many times on this episode, and it was infuriating me because I grew up in a very, very white area where lots of white people love to talk about not white people playing the race card and how those people are just, you know, trying to play the race card and not own up to their own actions because they're so bad. I grew up with a lot of racism that I didn't know about until I got older, right? And so it was fascinating to me to hear that type of language coming from Vince McMahon. The, you know, we know him as the commentator of the interview, but also we know that he owns the company. And knowing that he's the one in charge of these storylines, it's very obvious that Vince has no idea what he's trying to do with this kind of story. Like, he's trying to introduce something that's very provocative and discussing racial issues and being very current, but he has no idea how to handle it. And I like that Ahmed Johnson, as a babyface, didn't just go along with it and go, yeah, Farouk's playing the race card and he's awful and I'm a happy-go-lucky babyface who will dance for you now. Like, I'm glad that Ahmed's not that kind of guy. I'm glad that Ahmed said, first of all, I was hoping you didn't come to me with that question, but you did anyway. Because, you know, maybe Ahmed Johnson doesn't want to have to speak for all black people. Imagine that. Maybe Ahmed Johnson wants his title reign to be about more than being black, you know, when he gets to being the champion that he wants to be. But, you know, talking about Farouk being a racist and being a liar and being a cheat and all of that kind of stuff, and the fact that it really kind of gets to Ahmed too. You know, he asked Vince McMahon, when is the last time a black man had a shot at the world title? And Vince is like, well, people have gotten chances, but there has never been a black champion. Ahmed's just like, yeah, I wonder why. And, you know, having listened to the interview with Ahmed Johnson that you did, all 3 hours of it, I know that that's something that legitimately got to Ahmed Johnson. Like, when he asked Vince McMahon, why am I the first black champion? You know, when he was Intercontinental champion. And the whole thing is kind of fascinating to me because it's a white man writing stories about black culture and doesn't understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting topic. It's the thing that's weird is, like, now it's very, I don't think we cover racism a lot now in society as much. It's almost like we're in a very PC society in a lot of ways. We don't want to say things that would be offensive language to anyone, which is good in a lot of ways. But like in 1997, they just don't give a fuck. They just go. They just talk about it. You know, like Farouk's just like, why the fuck's Robert a black WWF champion? You're like, oh fuck, okay, he's going there. Good for him.
Mm-hmm.
We then.
But Ahmed makes sure to point out that, you know, he's not a racist. He likes everybody, and everybody likes him. And, you know, he's like, they believe in me because I tell it like it is. So he's like, people, you know, white, black, whatever, they believe in me because I tell it like it is and I tell them the truth. I mean, albeit the mumbled truth, because it is Ahmed Johnson. So sometimes we don't know what he's saying, but bless his heart, he always speaks the truth according to Ahmed Johnson.
Indeed. We then cut backstage to Steve Austin. He's trying to convince Harvey Whippleman to be his tag team partner next week.
I didn't know who this was at first, but it was a skinny white man who just in glasses.
Former manager
the Brooklyn Brawler
of Sid Justice
comes in at one point.
Whoa! Don't be over fucking. Don't be fucking passing on yet. Harvey Whippleman. Let me read the fucking man's resume.
All
Harvey
right.
Whippleman, former manager of Sid Justice.
Wow.
Managed Sid Justice in a WrestleMania main event against Hulk Hogan. Harvey Whippleman, the man who brought the joy of Kamala to the World Wrestling Federation. Harvey Whippleman has accomplishments.
Oh, with the bowling ball? Was he in that one?
No, that was Slick.
Oh.
But Harvey Whippleman's white. But yeah, you're right. They was.
I forgot who was actually in the video. I did watch it, but
Kamala,
it was a long time ago.
Kamala came in with his handler, Kim Shi, who was actually Brooklyn Brawler in a mask. And Harvey Whippleman, who was like the American, basically trying to get, you know, bring them in and make money out of them. And then Kamala became a babyface, and Slick was his manager, and they went against Kim Shi and Harvey Whippleman and some heel stuff. So, anyway, tries to get Harvey Whippleman to be his partner, which is basically Steve Austin's way of saying he wants to go it alone. Brooklyn Brawler then comes in to say he wants to be his tag partner, and Austin just can't stand him, so just beats him up. Which is great, because it's exactly what Steve Austin would do. And it looks like Steve
and
Austin...
And Harvey Whippleman doesn't even want to be Steve Austin's partner necessarily, but Austin's just like, you're going to be my tag team partner because I say you're going to be my partner.
So as of this point, we're going to see two tag team championship matches next week. Owen Hart and the British Bulldog against Ken Shamrock and Shawn Michaels, and Owen Hart and the British Bulldog against Stone Cold Steve Austin and Harvey Whippleman. To be determined. Up next, we have Farouk with his Nation of Domination taking on Rocky Maivia, who seems to just be going nowhere now in WWF. And Farouk defeats Rocky very easily in like 3 minutes. And after the match, Crush and Savio Vega beat up Rocky Maivia, and Farouk gets them to stop and makes them leave. And that's the end of that.
Which was intriguing. To me, knowing, of course, that The Rock becomes part of Nation of Domination and all of that. But I guess this is kind of the start of that. Like,
see.
I guess. I mean, apparently the show was running long at this point, and we're not going to get to see that Godwin's match they've been talking about, so that was a big bummer to me.
How are you going to get through it?
I just don't know. It'll be on Shotgun instead, so apparently
Shotgun
I'll have to...
Saturday night.
Yeah, I'm just not going to watch Shotgun Saturday night, so I will never see that match, apparently. Vince does mention that the rappers aren't around anymore after the Legion of Doom match last week, and Lawler was like, they never stood a chance. It was like Farouk just sacrificed them, and then Vince just comes back with, oh, really?
I do just want to say very quickly a couple of notes that, PG-13 are gone. There was a story where they thought that Jerry Lawler had them fired because they were working against him in Tennessee, but everybody in the company was denying it. They were told they might be brought in for the light heavyweight division, but it would likely only be for TV. And apparently JC Ice had gotten a lot of heat for when he was in the company. The Funkettes have been officially let go.
Oh.
As a cost-cutting measure.
Nadine and Tracy.
Right? You could have put a gun to my head and I wouldn't be able to say their names. Apparently they were, WWF were trying to get them to drop their per show price because it was an expensive entourage act for a guy who's not super over, and basically they wouldn't drop the price, so WWE let them go. And then Freddie Joe Floyd, who used to be on TV, has been let go as well. So
big Freddie.
So we go next to the Hart Foundation beating the shit out of Bob Holly, which, you know, fair enough.
It's gang warfare, that's all it is, says JR.
Vince McMahon brings out The Undertaker. He wants to talk about The Secret. Undertaker doesn't want to talk about it. He wants to talk about Farouk. He says, he talks about not seeing race. And do you want to talk about this promo? Because I don't want to talk about it, and then you're going to somehow have read out or something. Talk about Undertaker's promo.
Let's see. I'm seeing if I have it all written down. Oh, I do. So he says, last week, Farouk decided to play the race card. Well, Farouk, you need to understand that the Undertaker, he's not the white savior, because I don't recognize color. I'm not white. I'm not black. What I am is the Reaper of Wayward Souls. And when it's all said and done, and the King of the Ring is all over, and you're sitting in your dressing room, and you're wondering why you're not the World Wrestling Federation champion, well, you can be rest assured, it's not because you're black. It's because you couldn't beat the Undertaker. And then Vince asked him again about the secret, and the Undertaker's like, this is not the time. And then Paul Bearer's like, oh, yes, it is, dead man. It is the time right now.
I love because that Paul so Bearer much.
Is I love, amazing.
I love that the Undertaker actively, like, faces up to, like, racism, right? And he's like, I'm not black, I'm not white, I'm just fucking the guy. And then, like, he's like, I'm going to beat Farouk, it's all good. King of the Ring's over, I'm going to be the champ. And then Paul Bearer, and then Vince is like, mate, what's your secret? And Paul Bearer's like, you need to tell them, Undertaker. It's so good. I love it so much. And Paul Bearer's just, like, the most absurd human of all
He's
time.
He's great. I love him. He has always been one of my favorite performers, and that has not changed, seeing him on Retro Raw. It's only made my love for him grow more. And, I mean, he's saying things like, remember that drizzly morning when we lowered your mother and father into the earth? And he's like, fires opened up some old wounds. You burned me, and now I'm going to hurt you. And Undertaker's just like, Paul, wait. Why should I wait? And Undertaker's like, Paul. And Paul's like, come back to me now, Undertaker, or I will let it out. So I guess the whole thing is Paul Bearer wants the Undertaker to come back to him, or he's going to reveal this dreadful, dreadful secret to everyone. And it's so, like, if I didn't know what the secret was, I would be like, I really want to fucking know what this secret is, because it's something the Undertaker doesn't even want to mention, right? Like, he doesn't even want to mention the idea that there is a secret. And Paul Bearer is just such a fucking delight that I'm like, I kind of want to know.
And so he's got till next week, and Undertaker has to give him an answer. And if Undertaker doesn't return to him, he's going to open Pandora's box and tell them the secret. And oh,
human eye has not seen, human ear has not heard the secret I have on you.
And Taker's fucking gutted.
Oh, he's so, like, he's not even angry. He's just like, he looks like he's been punched in the gut. Like, this is the worst thing that could possibly happen to the Undertaker.
So that takes us to the main event, which is going to be Stone Cold Steve Austin against Jim the Anvil Neidhart. Pop fact for everybody, this is the first match for Jim the Anvil Neidhart on Monday Night Raw since December of 1994.
Wow.
Unless you count when he was who? That's right. From where? Weighing what? Who?
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Was he under a mask or something?
Yes, he was.
Ah.
But basically, as soon as the bell rings, they kind of start wrestling, but they get like a minute in, and then like Pillman attacks Steve Austin with a crutch.
Yeah, because Pillman was on commentary for this.
Yeah, for like the minute of it that it happened. And he runs in, and the Hart Foundation are beating up Austin, and then Michaels makes the save, and then once they sort of clean house, Vince announces that Gorilla Monsoon has confirmed that next week Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels will have to team up together against Owen Hart and the British Bulldog for the tag team titles. So,
because why did it take this long to figure that out?
Poor Ken Shamrock and poor Harvey Whippleman. Will Harvey Whippleman, this is for long time fans, will Harvey Whippleman ever get his chance at World Wrestling Federation gold? I wonder if he will. Anyway, Owen Hart and the Bulldog will have to defend against Shawn Michaels and Steve Austin next week, and then Austin and Michaels get another brawl because they hate each other, and that's the end of the show.
Yeah, they're not very happy about this whole situation. They're like, we don't want to have to team together, which was the whole point anyway. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that at least Gorilla Monsoon did come to, you know, his senses and say, no, that's kind of not what the deal was. I mean, I'm not super sure why Owen Hart can make matches, but Gorilla Monsoon had to sign off on it, and Owen was probably like, no, I'm not willing to do the match if they don't team up. So that's, you know, I'm glad that was rectified in the end. The one I feel bad for, though, is Ken Shamrock, because I don't think that Harvey Whippleman was really anticipating this match all that much. He didn't look to be that excited about being involved as Steve Austin's tag team partner. But Ken Shamrock, he seemed to be kind of all in, right? Like, he was supporting Shawn Michaels. They had a game plan going. They'd all, you know, figured this all out. So poor Ken Shamrock, he thought he was going to maybe get tag team gold, and now he just doesn't get that chance. So I hope that they have something else for him, because I really like Ken Shamrock. But
where,
I don't know. This,
it, where is your
it made me want to see more of Jim the Anvil Neidhart versus Stone Cold Steve Austin, though, because they were kind of beating the shit out of each other, and it was great.
It was good. Where's your thumb for this episode?
Thumbs up for this episode, I think.
Yeah.
Like, it was a lot of interviews and a lot of talking, but it accomplished quite a bit in my mind.
But they also had the thread, right, of the whole night. It was like Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels, can they coexist? And, like, I think that Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels is actually a pretty compelling babyface dynamic of two guys who are so polar opposite. But what's also interesting about them is they're
because
both...
neither of them are great babyfaces. Well, I mean, Steve Austin is at getting the crowd behind him, but he's not a proper, like, babyface character. And they want Shawn Michaels to be a proper babyface character, but he's a cunt. So
yeah, but what's interesting as well is, you know, they're so polar opposite and all that, but they're actually very similar because they both were born and raised in Texas, and they're both kind of like, you know, Texan boys. So there's some cool dynamics to it. So I thought this was a good show.
Yeah, that's true.
So we'll come back to it in a couple of days for the May 26th episode of Raw is War. Sandra, where can people find you on Twitter before we leave?
Find me on Twitter at SandraRuthRW. Find Kenny on Twitter at KennyMC1985. Follow Inside the Ropes at Inside_the Ropes. And check us out on Patreon for all of our retro pay-per-views, for our current non-brand-specific, or for our current brand-specific pay-per-views on Patreon as well. Almost fucked that up. Patreon.com/InsideTheRopes. Lots of content going up there all the time. It's more than a lot of people can handle, they say, but we like to, you know, we like to put out if you give us some money.
Well, not going to go there, but I just want to very quickly say thank you so much to everybody who subscribed on Patreon. I am obscenely thankful that you, like, a week, I mean, I feel like 2 weeks ago we had like 350, 360 patrons, and now we have 454.
Yeah, it's crazy how much it's grown in the past week.
And, you know, the thing is, the more of you, I'm not trying to sales pitch you, but the more of you that subscribe, the more that we're able to sort of share all the stuff and then do more content, you know. So and the thing, I know some people said, you know, there's so much content and, like, you know, I can't keep up with it, but, like, the way I approach it, and I know Sandra feels the same, and so does David and Robert, is that if you're giving us money, we need to earn that every single month, and that's what we try to do. So I do think that we are, and I will be challenged on this, and I think we are the best value Patreon page there is. So, for content,
we're the best one that I've seen, and I've checked out quite a few of them.
Yeah, in terms of wrestling content, like, we give content all the time. Classic ITR, like Sandra said, brand specific pay per view reviews, retro pay per view reviews, all the $50 people that want us to talk about content, we do that. We have interviews going up. We have conference calls. We have the Power Slam podcast 24 hours before everybody else hears it on YouTube. Tons of
which is a really good podcast, by the way. I really enjoyed episode one.
Thank you. And Finn Martin, a really great addition to the team. Can't believe that, you know, without Finn Martin, Inside the Ropes would not be a thing, without question. So it's only fair that he gets to come on and be a part of the team. So yeah, thanks for everybody who's subscribed and pledged and all that sort of stuff, and hopefully we can keep growing that and getting bigger and better. Also, Goldberg coming to the UK in just 1 month's time, so do get your tickets at insidetheropes.co.uk. Come hear him talk. He's never talked about his career at length, and I promise you, if you come to Glasgow, Manchester and London, I'm going to ask him the tough questions about every run he's had, and I'm sure it's going to be a very interesting night for sure. So we'll be back in a couple of days with another Retro Raw. By the time you're listening to this, we've probably got the SmackDown summary up as well, so do check them out. And that's about it, Sandra. So I guess all that's left to say is, here to play us out is the song of Mobile, Alabama's own Bob Thurman, Sparky Plug Holly.
Vroom, vroom, vroom.